I'm delighted to once again welcome our public radio audience, for those who are listening to a Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations presentation for the first time. Let me introduce ourselves. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the board of the forum, which was founded in 1983 by a small group living in the Midcoast area with an interest in the role of the United States in international relations. Membership is currently about 150, includes former diplomats, international businessmen, retired academics, and others with an interest in foreign affairs. For further information, please see our website at www.midcoastforum.org. We have a monthly luncheon meeting, usually the first or second Monday, to hear an informed speaker discuss a topic of international interest. Our September meeting will be September 27th, when Ira Glasser, long-serving executive director of the ACLU and currently head of the Drug Policy Alliance, an organization dedicated to reversing what it considers this nation's ill-considered war on drugs. The title of his topic is The War on the War on Drugs. In October, our meeting will be October 18th. Graham Fuller, well-known expert on the Middle East. He was a station chief in the Yemen. He served in Turkey. He served in China. He's approached the Middle East from about four different directions, as well as in the center. He spoke to the forum about 10 years ago when we were still over the sail-off? Yeah. And he's going to talk about Turkey, his provocative title. It's more provocative than actual, is Who Lost Turkey? That's October 18th. Today, we're very lucky to have Ambassador Goodwin Cook. Goody graduated from Harvard in 1953, was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the U.S. Marine Corps, and began his career with the State Department in 1956. Serving as a Foreign Service officer until 1981 with postings in Pakistan, Yugoslavia, Italy, Belgium, Canada, and the Ivory Coast. In his final posting, he served as U.S. Ambassador to the Central African Republic. Since leaving the Foreign Service, Ambassador Cook has been a professor at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. He's now Professor of Practice Emeritus in International Relations. So we're delighted to have Goody Cook today talking about the politics of the Dark Continent.
It's a little embarrassing. When I talked to Douglas Hartley, who invited me up here, I said I would like to talk about nations and states, about the question of ethnicity in international relations, which I'm going to do. I don't care what Mac has said. Who's giving this talk anyway? So I'm slightly out of line here, but you'll have to bear with me. It's a very interesting subject. The question of nationalism is extremely difficult to address. Almost nobody addresses it from an academic viewpoint. It mingles anthropology and political science. And those two disciplines are usually at either end of the building. The faculty sometimes meet in the cafeteria. At Syracuse, they talk about faculty parking and the basketball team. So that they really don't get together. There's no overlap. I was asked to do a course for the honors program at Syracuse by a great scholar who knew nothing about anything. He was a medical philosopher, I think. And he said, Goody, I want something that's never been taught before. And I drew for this upon Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a wonderful, delightful, erudite, superb lecturer, particularly before lunch, I should point out. After lunch, he was a little more difficult. In the evening, he was sometimes impossible. But he, after he left the Senate, he took a position at Syracuse and would come up twice a year and give a lecture on something important like Social Security. But we were old pals, and he came and lectured for me. He was a superb lecturer. My courses were all in the morning. When he came, he said, "What's Goody Cook teaching now?" And he's teaching X, Y, or Z. Sometimes I was teaching ethics and international affairs, which is an unusual course, very short course, of course. And he was going to talk about ethics and ethnicity in international affairs, and he died the day before, and I missed it. If I'd had that, I'd have been a wealthy man. He's written a most entertaining book on this subject, and his lectures always were on this subject from different aspects. I cannot rival him in erudition or wit, but I want to talk about this subject. I call it nations and states, and it's the intersection of ethnicity and statehood that is the problem that we have not resolved and have no way to resolve. Let me start with a state which everyone knows about. Everyone knows that the system of sovereign states was established in 1648 after the Thirty Years' War by the Peace of Westphalia. It was the dream child of Cardinal Richelieu, who was the advisor to Louis XIII of France. He's the villain in The Three Musketeers, but he was actually a very brilliant and able man. Incidentally, as The Three Musketeers, Anne of Austria probably did have an affair with the Duke of Buckingham, but everybody else did too. He was the Warren Beatty of aristocratic mid-century France, Europe. He died before the peace was resolved, but the peace he solved the problem of the 30 Years' War, which was religion, of course, by creating a system of totally sovereign states. States were to have defined borders, and within those borders, the government was completely sovereign. It controlled all the people within the borders, except diplomats, and all people within the borders were expected to obey the orders and rules laid down by the government. The government can tax us. The government can draft us into the army. The government has the right to arrest us, to torture us, to put us in prison, to execute us. All of those things are under the control of the sovereign government. And the government does not like to give up its sovereignty. The government has control of the borders. If you're going to cross the border, you need permission from the government, unless it gives a generalized permission. You need a visa. And if you cross the borders by force, that's aggression, that's war, and the government can punish you for crossing the borders by force and attack you in reverse and punish you for if it wins the war. It can determine the religion of the states in 1648, and kings in 1648 did. There were Protestant kings and Catholic kings in Europe. And if you were not of the right religion, the government could put you in prison or on the rack or do what it wished with you. That is the system by which the whole world is ruled today. The Westphalian system was spread to include the entire world. There are almost no people left who do not live in, quotes, sovereign states. Most states do not exercise the right to determine the religion of the state. There are a couple, I think, of Arab states that do, but they can if they wish. Most states do not torture us and so forth. But they can if they wish, and that's within their sovereign control. And they can do that. There are some people don't know they live in a sovereign state, tribes up the Amazon or in Papua New Guinea someplace, or perhaps Eskimos in the frozen north who don't know they live in it, but they do. There are a few colonies left, not very many, and most of the people in them want to stay in the colonies, Gibraltar, the Falkland Islands. There was one nice one when I was in Canada. The Turks and Caicos Islands, the two little islands in the Caribbean, under Great Britain, and Britain said, "We are going to give you independence. We'll send Prince Philip over and he'll pull down the flag." And he, "No, we don't want to be independent. We're fine. Give us a governor general. We're happy. Don't bother us." And British said, "We're going ahead." They sent a delegation to Canada and said, "Could we be part of Canada? Could we be your colony?" And the Canadians were sort of looking at it, and we got to the House of Commons, and somebody realized that every member of the House of Commons had the right to visit any place in Canada once a month. Normally so they could get from Ottawa to the Yukon, but in February, the Turks and Caicos looked pretty good, so it was that hit the papers, and that was scotched. So there are a few colonies left, but there are a few anomalies like Taiwan, which isn't often recognized as a state but acts like a sovereign state. But the only people I can think of who do not live in a sovereign Westphalian state under the control of a sovereign state are the Palestinians in the West Bank of the Jordan River and in Gaza, but they are under the control of the Israeli army and not of the Israeli state. They're not subject to a sovereign state. But I don't know of any others. There may be some, if you can tell me. And states are anxious to preserve their sovereignty. That's what states do. If a group of people within a state wish to secede from the state and make another state, they have to take a piece of territory with them or go find some place that hasn't been taken. But there's every place is took. So there's no place for them to go except take territory from the state. And I can think of only one example when a state has voluntarily given up territory for a group of people who wish to secede, which is Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia, who allowed the Slovaks to leave. And he said, this is asinine. We speak very much the same language. We get along. We've been together. What the blazes? And they said, it's too complicated, Mr. President. Well, okay, go ahead. Now the Slovaks want back in, and the Czechs don't want them. But the European Union has sort of taken over that, so free trade flourishes, and this is one way to work it out. But other than that, I think the Canadians would give territory to the Quebecois if the referendum went the wrong way. But it got up to 49% voted for an independent Quebec. It's now down to 53 or 54. An interesting thing is that when a new state is established, the people in it immediately want sovereignty. The Quebecers have said, we want sovereignty over the Quebec province. The Indians in northern Quebec say, if we don't mind living in Canada, but we're sure not going to live in independent Quebec. And the Quebecers, oh, yes, you are. Once we get our territory, you are in our sovereign state, and we will control you just as much. A nation is something different. It's complicated. A nation may evolve from an ethnic group. We all know what we think of an ethnic group in anthropology study. An ethnic group will almost always have a name. Often the name in the language, if they have their own language, will mean people. So the Eskimo word for people is Inuit. We call them Inuit. We call them Inuit people. We're saying they're the people people. Sometimes they don't, but mostly they'll have a name. They will often have a myth as to their ancestry, a myth which they believe in. Jews and Arabs, for example, believe in their descent from Abraham. Hopis and Navajos have their own myth. Not always, but most of them. Sometimes they will have a religion. Sometimes they'll have their own language. Almost always they have customs about marriage and costumes and eating and celebrations and so forth that identify them and differentiate them from people who are not members of that ethnic group. They can be defined. Ethnic groups are primordial. They go back forever. How old are the Persians? How old are the Jews? How long have there been Jews or Persians or Kurds or Slavs or Han Chinese? Or you name it. We can't trace their origins. They've just been there since forever. And until I started teaching about this stuff when I started teaching at Syracuse, because nationalism was affecting the system of sovereign states. And what we believed was that nationalism happened when an ethnic group somehow came to the determination that it wanted to be a sovereign state or to be an autonomous group. There was no clear definition about that. And more scholarship has come up since I've started teaching at Syracuse. Most of it's quite modern, beginning with Benedict Anderson, whose books Imagined Communities came out in the late 70s, I think. Walker Connor at Dartmouth and Anthony Smith, who's still alive at Cambridge in England, have been reading about it. But if you go in to look at books on nationalism in your library, there's only three or four authors who've dealt with modern scholarship on this. The great age of nationalism began in Europe in the 19th century. And people said, why? Why all of a sudden in Europe, after how many years, did suddenly nationalities suddenly want their own states? They'd live under the Habsburg Empire for 400 years. All of a sudden, we had Czechs and Hungarians and Serbs and others suddenly demanding their own state. What happened? The answer which the modern scholars have offered is literacy. They learned to read. So they learned that there were other people like them. A little village in Germany in the deep forest might know something that people know something about the next village over where they spoke the same language and had the same customs, so they're quite like us. How many of them were there? How would you unite them? How could they get together? They didn't. what happened was they learned to read and then developed print journalism. In England in the 18th century, in France in the late 18th century, more and more people learned to read and learned that there are other people like them out there. Now, nationalist groups survive in diasporas with tremendous force. Think in Los Angeles, when a young Armenian whose family has lived in Los Angeles for three generations, who hardly doesn't speak a word of Armenian, goes and throws a firebomb at the Turkish consulate general because of the refusal of the modern Turkish government to recognize the genocides practiced by the Sultanate in 1917, when his grandfather hadn't been born. Oh, God, that happened to my family. Tremendous tension. The feeling of closeness amongst a national group is extraordinarily strong. And it probably happened because of journalism and the idea that we have to have our own state and can have our own state, probably developed with the French Revolution. The French Revolution suggested you don't need to have a king. The people can govern. Popular sovereignty can work. We had a little revolution just before that, but we were a tiny little place clinging to the shores and nobody knew we existed. Was the France was the greatest power in Europe, probably the greatest power in the world. And so when the French monarch fell, all the monarchs in Europe shook in their shoes. And what happened was that the French had become a nation and were able to defeat the armies of Europe almost easily because they were fighting for France. They suddenly believed in themselves. They weren't all part of this nation. In 1850, there was a very famous book written in the 1930s about this. In the 1850s in France, probably half the people in France didn't know they lived in France. But enough of them knew they lived in France to follow Napoleon. And Napoleon, who may not have been a great strategist, could inspire the French nation to fight. And people fighting for their nation became tremendously, tremendously effective. And this spread. So we had a Serbian Revolution. And what happened? Douglas Hartley and I were together in Belgrade. He knows, as I do, that in the 19th century, Vuk Karadzic taught the Serbs to read. And then they could read the ancient poems about Kosovo and the fall of Kosovo in 1389 to the Turks. And they suddenly realized, wait a minute, we're all Serbs. And they drove the Turks out of Serbia in the 19th century. The Czechs and Slovaks did much the same thing. In Scandinavia, the same thing happened. The Finns, who were largely illiterate, suddenly wrote a national epic, pretended it was a long-lost folk epic, it was written about 1830, the Kalevala. My God, we are Finns! And all of a sudden they defeated the Russians and the Swedes and all this sort of stuff and developed their own architecture and became a nation. I don't know, has anybody read St. Joan by George Bernard Shaw? You remember in the introduction, he says that Joan was probably the first nationalist, and maybe the first Protestant. She probably was a nationalist, but France was not a nation. So that her wonderful inspiration of a few soldiers and the Dauphin was not sufficient to last. In other words, the French did not become a nation really until probably after the French Revolution. And the same is true elsewhere in Europe. Now the Westphalian system is spread all over the world. And what has happened is that, particularly in Africa, about which I'm supposed to speak, the Europeans put a Westphalian grid on Africa. And they did it not based on ethnicity or language or even geography, because they hadn't been there. They had a big blank map, and the French said, we'll have this, and the British said, we'll have that, and they said lines, and said, this is our provincial borders. Went down and found a mountain and a lake and a river and stuff. When the map, it said, Cave Hic Dragones, when they got there, but then they declared independent states. And the mixed ethnicities in these independent states suddenly said, who is going to govern? And for whom will we vote? So they voted for ethnicities, not for more taxation or less. And that has led to civil wars endlessly in Sudan with the Muslim government in the north and a strong Christian and animist group called the Dinka in the south. Arabs in the north and black sub-Saharan Africans in the south, There has been civil war since Sudan was founded without a break, except in 2004 when George Bush, one of the good things he's done, inspired by evangelistic Christians, arranged a truce between the Christian South and the Arab North, which is coming to a referendum in January when the South is going to vote whether to stay part of Sudan. It will vote against that, and there will be civil war, dollars to donuts, next February in Sudan. Chad has been at civil war most of the time with Arabs in the north and blacks in the south. There's an ethnic fault line that runs across the middle of Africa from Mauritania to Sudan. And on the north, there are Arabs and Muslims. And on the south, there are Christians and animists who are mostly black. And there have been civil wars in Nigeria, Ivory Coast, and country after country along that ethnic fault line. And what happened in Africa was that the African leaders understood this and got together when the African Organization of African Unity was found and discussed it and said, we ought to redo the borders, and then thought about it and said, we can't possibly do that. That'll be endless civil war. We will have to decide to stay with the borders we have. And they agreed that we will not try to alter our borders. It's one of the first decisions made by the Organization of African Unity. I think it's a wise decision, but they are stuck with this question of ethnicity. What many of them did was what is called nation building. We'll try to build nationality. We have citizenship. We don't have nationality. Let us try to build it. In Ivory Coast, it was quite successful when I was there. It fell apart, civil war very soon after. Not my fault. In Ivory Coast, they had big pictures saying, people all smiling and saying, you'd smile too if you lived in Cote d'Ivoire. To say, yeah, we are all Ivorians. I am not of this or of that or the other an ethnic group. But these lines, of course, divided ethnic groups. The border between Ghana and Ivory Coast goes right through the middle of the Ashanti people, so that to the east they speak English and to the west they speak French. The border has never been examined. You've never been, the forest is too deep to do much surveying. So people wander back and forth and speak Ashanti, but they are two separate sovereign states, different currencies and different rules and so forth. So it's a very, very tough problem for Africans. After the great burst of nationalism in the 19th century, we came to the First World War. And a new element was added to this mix by Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson went to Versailles. He was enormously popular. The French went crazy about him. Every town in France still has a boulevard Woodrow Wilson. Geneva, where he put the League of Nations, has a boulevard, a quay, a hotel, a karaoke bar. They're really wild about Woodrow Wilson. One of the things he brought was not part of the 14 points, but when he got to France, he suddenly said, what we really want is self-determination of peoples. Nobody knew what he meant, including himself. He did not explain it. He just said, I believe in the self-determination of peoples. Well, he didn't. Well, maybe he did. He was born in the South and was raised in a slaveholding family as a very young boy. But we don't believe in the self-determination of peoples. When half the country seceded, we saw to it they stayed in the Union. Almost nobody believed in the self-determination of peoples. What a wonderful phrase. Don't raise your hand and say, I don't believe in the self-determination of peoples, because of course you do. We do. One of the people who disagreed with was his Secretary of State, Robert Lansing. I have a mark in here somewhere. Robert Lansing, who was from Watertown, just north of Syracuse. And he wrote a note on this. Wilson paid no attention to the Secretary of State. And Lansing is a darn good Secretary of State. The more I think about the President's declaration on self-determination, the more convinced I am of the danger of putting such ideas into the minds of certain races. It is bound to be the basis of impossible demands on the Peace Congress and create trouble in many lands. The phrase is loaded with dynamite. It will raise hopes which can never be realized. It will cost thousands of lives. In the end, it is bound to be discredited, to be called the dream of an idealist who failed to realize the danger until too late to check those who attempt to put the thing into force. What a calamity. What misery it will cause. a man who is a leader of public thought should be aware of intemperate or undigested declarations. He is responsible for the consequences. Actually, the British and the French people said, what a great idea. The British and the French government said, we had extensive colonial holdings. Well, that's for other folks, not for us. And what the British and the French did, they said, we got to end empires. Wilson and Clemenceau and Lloyd George and what's his name, the Italian, put maps on the floor in Versailles, and in their tailcoats and striped pants, got down with on all fours with the 1919 equivalent of magic markers, crawling around and creating new states. They broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire and created Czechoslovakia and Hungary. The rest of it in the south, they called the country of the Serbs, Croats, and Slovenes, later called Yugoslavia, including Croatia and Serbs, who did not like each other at all, and drew a line around it and said, that's a new state. And this was self-determination. We'll decide who determines what. Nobody asked the people on the ground about that. They certainly didn't ask the Croats, who quickly killed the Serbian king, and so forth. They also decided secretly and during the war to break up the Turkish Empire. Two diplomats, what's his name? George Sykes and Jean-François Picot, got together and did a map of how to break up the southern part of the Turkish Empire, in particular what are now the states of Iraq, Jordan, Israel, and the occupied territories, Syria, and Lebanon. And having done that map, they then got the League of Nations to give them a mandate to take this territory away from Turkey and govern it. They divided it. Britain got what is now Iraq, Jordan, Israel, and the occupied territories, and the French got what is now Lebanon and Syria. The French created the state of Lebanon, just drew a line. The British didn't know quite how to deal with this, and I'll talk most particularly about Iraq because it's of relevant interest. They got to Iraq and stormed in because they were resisted. Iraq was three Turkish provinces, or they called vilayet. The southern province was a Shia Arab province governed from Basra. The center and west was a Sunni Arab province governed from Baghdad. And the north and northeast was a Kurdish province governed from Kirkuk. So the British stormed in. They had to kill quite a lot of Shia Arabs getting there. And as they got north, they had to kill Sunni Arabs and Kurds. They used gas, which they learned how to use in the First World War. And when they came to Baghdad, the general of the British armies announced, we come not as conquerors, but as liberators. If that sounds familiar, it should indeed. Then they had to decide how to govern these three provinces, which didn't like each other. This was not actually done by the British governor general or the general commanding the armies. It was the effort of a quite lovely, beautiful, very, very intelligent, forceful, thoroughly batty English woman named Gertrude Bell. Those who have not read Queen of the Desert, it's a very good book. She was a stunning woman. She graduated from Oxford with high honors. Her father was a don, and then couldn't get a job. All you could do was get married or be a secretary or a servant. So she went to Jerusalem and learned Arabic and set off across the desert on a camel. She loved Arabs and sand and camels, all platonically, I assure you. She had British boyfriends. She founded the wonderful Baghdad Archaeological Museum and became a tremendous expert on the area. So when the British governor general was there, Gertrude Bell became a top advisor. And she decided that this should be governed as one country, these three disparate ethnic groups who were not particularly friendly with one another. People begged her not to. Gertrude, she's an American missionary. Gertrude, these people have been just separated for 4 millennia. You're going against 4,000 years of history here. You just can't do that. But she could. And she persuaded Winston Churchill, all right, we'll govern this one place. How will we go? Well, you need a king. So the king was proposed by Lawrence of Arabia. Lawrence, of course, had gotten the sheriff of Mecca in what is now Saudi Arabia, but then just Arabia. He'd helped Lawrence to liberate Syria and Palestine. After the war, the sheriff of Mecca was pressed by the House of Saud, which was gradually taking over Arabia, and he would go into exile. And he called on Lawrence and said, look, I have two boys, and I think they need employment. And so Lawrence said, I'll take care of it. And they sent the older boy, Faisal, to Damascus to be king. And the French said, hey, no, we run Damascus. You take him someplace else. So they took him to Baghdad, and they made him king. He was more or less accepted by Sunni Arabs, but the Shia Arabs didn't want him, and the Kurds certainly didn't want him, and nobody wanted him from Mecca. He was 800 miles away. He'd never been in Baghdad. So the British had to kill quite a few Kurds and Shia Arabs and some Sunni Arabs to get them to accept the king, and continued to kill them until they could build an army for the king, which they did. It's familiar also. And the army continued to do this for the king until 1950, when the army took over and killed the king. It's actually his grandson and his famous prime minister, Nur el-Said. And they ruled, and it was a Sunni army by this time. They ruled until the 1970s, when the Ba'ath Party took over, and then Saddam Hussein, and he killed Shia Arabs and Kurds with a ferocity that his predecessors had not matched until we kicked him out in 2003. Actually, after the first Gulf War, there's a very interesting episode, because he went after the Kurds, and they fled. And we saw them, we all saw them on the mountains in Turkey freezing, and we intervened. Iraq was still a sovereign state. We signed a ceasefire with Iraq. We had not declared war in Iraq. But seeing the Kurds in this misery, we and the British and the French began to overfly Iraqi Kurdistan and bomb Iraqi forces. And Saddam Hussein said, you are violating Iraqi sovereignty. I'm a member of the United Nations. You may not bomb my country. And he was right. However, we went ahead anyway, on the basis of some UN resolutions, which are marginally relevant. And actually what happened was that the Kurds flourished as never before in their history, and still do, because right now Kurdistan has an international airport and hotels and wonderful, there's trout fishing. Our people go up there for R&R. It's a beautiful, marvelous place. Because we intervened in a sovereign state to protect its population against its government. It's a brand new thing. I can't think of another time that that's happened. The British tried in Macedonia when there was the war between Macedonia and Turkey, to free Macedonia, but it was so horrible the British couldn't stand it and went home. So this is a brand new development. Intervention to save a people from their government without overthrowing the government. A remarkable thing to do. Where do we go from here? The problem is that we do recognize sovereignty. We all believe in sovereignty. No place is more sovereign than the United States. If somebody wants to secede from the United States, we say no. All states, or almost all states, feel the same way. But we all declare our interest in the self-determination of peoples. Self-determination was used by Hitler at Munich. He told Woodrow Wilson, and he told Chamberlain, that we are following President Wilson's dictum about the self-determination of peoples. The Sudeten Germans, who live in Czechoslovakia, are Germans. And they have the right to determine their own future, and want to see to it that they can. So why are you here bothering me? Stalin, of course, used it to great effect to protest after World War II, the colonial era, say that all these people have the right to self-determination. You put it in the United Nations Charter. If you read the United Nations Charter, the purposes of the United Nations are to preserve peace and end the scourge of war and all these good things, and enforce the right of self-determination of peoples, not defined. But Article 1, Paragraph 5 says, nothing in this charter shall permit the United States or any other state to interfere in matters which are essentially under the sovereignty of another state. So to go into another state to help people to secede is obviously violating the sovereignty. And how do you determine when to violate the sovereignty? How do you approve a group that secedes, and under what grounds? During World War II, we continued to recognize the Baltic states of Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. One of them had an embassy up here. I think Lithuania had an embassy in Washington. The other two had consulate generals in New York, which we recognized as representing those states, although they'd been taken by Stalin and absorbed into the Soviet Union, as provinces of the Soviet Union. After the war, after the Cold War ended, some of you may remember in 1990, many parts of the Soviet Union wanted to leave, particularly Ukraine. And George Bush Sr. went to Kiev and gave a speech and said, "You can be free without being independent." In other words, now there's a democratic government, Boris Yeltsin, Boris Yeltsin in Moscow. You can be free. You do not need an independent state of Ukraine. So we oppose, once we got a government we liked in Moscow, we started opposing secession. But of course, the Ukrainians, remembering Stalin's having starved 4 million Ukrainians in the 1930s, said, we're not going to tolerate that nonsense. And there are now 16 different countries, sovereign states in the Soviet Union. One of the things that happens is when you declare a new sovereign state, parts of that sovereign state often will say, we don't want to be in your state. We want our own state. Why should I be a minority in your state when I can declare independence and make you a minority in my state? Georgia, which is a small state, southern part of the Caucasus, declared its independence. Edward Shevardnadze, who had been Gorbachev's foreign minister, who was Georgian, became president of Georgia. And the first thing that happened, that the independence movements within Georgia, in the north, a tiny group of people called South Ossetians wanted independence. They're not Georgian, they're Muslims, they didn't want any part of Georgia or its Christianity. Another over in the northwest, the Abkhaz, wanted their own state. There are about 500,000 of them. And another group down in the southwest of the country on the Black Sea wanted independence too, and was granted some kind of autonomy so that they're all right. And Shevardnadze said, no, you are staying in Georgia and don't give me any of that nonsense. But they continue to protest and to demonstrate. The Ossetians are interested. They're pushed west by the Mongols, and there's a big mountain range up there. The South Ossetians, 70,000 of them, hardly bigger than Rockland, 70,000 of them live south of the mountains, and the North Ossetians live north of the mountains. You can't get over the mountains in the winter, but Stalin dug a tunnel underneath. However, they're quite separate, and the South Ossetians do not want to be Georgian. In Yugoslavia, there's a group in Kosovo, a very important part of Yugoslavia, Serbia, to the Serbs, because the great Serbian kingdom was there, which was destroyed by the Turks in 1389. The people who live there are Albanian. So the Kosovar Albanians declared they wanted to have their own country. They wanted to be more autonomous. Tito had given them autonomy. They wanted sovereignty. And Slobodan Milosevic, as you remember, in 1999, began to send forces into Kosovo to stop Kosovar terrorism, which it was. They were bombing police stations and doing bad things. We decided we couldn't stand that. We were sick of Slobodan Milosevic. So we bombed Kosovo to hit the Yugoslav forces. We bombed Belgrade. We bombed the Chinese embassy in Belgrade, which irritated the Chinese mightily. Actually, the CIA got the wrong map and said arms warehouse. It was wrong. So Kosovo was saved, and we filled it with NATO troops and Russian troops to keep the peace, because the Kosovars wanted to kill the Serbs that were in Kosovo. Serbia, has now become quite democratic. More democratic than ever before in its history. But Kosovo declared its independence 2 years ago and was instantly recognized by George W. Bush. We recognize the independent state of Kosovo. Well, Russians have an affinity for Serbs. They're different. but they both write Cyrillic. St. Cyril taught them to write in the 8th century. They are both Slavic. They are both Eastern Orthodox, and they've been allies in two world wars. So these Russians feel at ease with Serbs, and they were not going to recognize a secession from Serbia. So Kosovo will not be able to be sovereign and recognize the United Nations because the Russians have a veto in the Security Council. About the same time, the Ossetians declare their independence from Georgia. President Saakashvili, who is something less than a Jeffersonian Democrat, decided that was impossible, and he sent a force into Ossetia to try to quash these 70,000 people. But unfortunately, the Russians had several battalions or regiments of soldiers there, and they retaliated on behalf of the South Ossetians and got almost the way to Tbilisi. So we will not recognize the sovereignty of Ossetia or the sovereignty of Abkhazia, which has also declared its independence and been recognized by Russians and other states in the area. In other words, we like the government. We're against the secession. We don't like the government before the secession. And we, either way, we have something to say, we're for sovereignty or for self-determination of peoples. But you can't be for both. This has led to some very, very unpleasant circumstances because ethnic feelings and ethnic wars become tremendously powerful and very emotional, so that governments who find people seceding from them retaliate very brutally. So we have genocide, a horrible new word coined, I think, in the 1920s. So you've read Samantha Power's book, of course. And ethnic cleansing. What Slobodan Milosevic wanted to do in Kosovo was ethnic cleansing, kick all the Kosovar Albanians out. So we protected the Kosovars. Violating sovereignty. When can you cross the borders of another state to protect its citizens against their government while still recognize that government's sovereignty? And under what circumstances can you do it? Very tough. One effort has been made called the Responsibility to Protect. Michael Ignatieff, you may know, is head of the Liberal Party in Canada and maybe the next prime minister. He's the son of George Ignatieff, who, when I was in Ottawa, was the Canadian ambassador to the United Nations, and I knew him not well. Michael is a brilliant, brilliant man, a scholar of parts. He was at the Kennedy School at Harvard and ran the Institution on Human Rights there, and came up with this idea, which was done in an International Commission on Intervention in State Sovereignty in Canada, which he brought the people together to deal with. The proposition is that if a people in a sovereign state are being persecuted, it is the responsibility of that state to protect them. If that state cannot exercise that responsibility, or indeed is doing the oppression itself, then the international community has a responsibility to protect those people. It's very hard to deny that, having protected the Kurds against the wrath of Saddam Hussein and the Kosovars against the wrath of Slobodan Milosevic. Okay, what do we do about the four people in Darfur in western Sudan who were committing terrorist acts, and the Sudanese have launched bandits to raid them and kill them? There are about 5 million Darfurians, or Furians. Darfur means land of the four. About half of them have fled into Chad. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. We ought to go to protect them. We would then be violating Sudanese sovereignty. Well, the only people, presumably, or institution that can permit that is the United Nations Security Council. But, of course, China has tremendous oil interests in Sudan. So if we get to try to ask the Security Council permission to go in and save the four people, China will veto. So we don't ask. We don't want to go anyway. It's very inaccessible and extraordinarily difficult to do. But we cannot do it without the consent of the Security Council. In fact, almost none of these things, this responsibility to protect, can be exercised without getting the Security Council to vote on. And one suggestion made at this meeting was that they use the method used in the Korean War. I don't know how many of you remember, but when the North Koreans invaded the South Koreans, Harry Truman went to the UN and said, we want a UN force to go there. And the Russians had gone home in a huff. So they weren't in New York. And that meant that the Security Council, since they're all allies of the United States, voted for a UN force. And when I went to Japan with the Marine Corps, I got a nice blue medal. The war was over. I had a nice blue medal to wear, saying I was part of a UN force. The Russians came back right away and started vetoing everything possible. And we went to the General Assembly and got the Uniting for Peace resolution, saying that the Security Council was tied up. The General Assembly could exercise the powers of the Security Council and vote for forces to go places. So maybe we could do that. But with today's General Assembly, we're not going to get very far. So there's no way, legitimately, to exercise the responsibility to protect, and we are tied up. It is an agonizing problem, one we cannot solve. The best solution is to have benign governance, but if we had benign governance all over, we probably wouldn't need the United Nations. So that's the problem we face, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
We've got a bunch of questions. We've got written questions these days, Goody. And I tell you one thing. I just want to thank you very much for not following the title that I had suggested. The other title that we had promised a couple months ago was you were going to talk about Somalia. Whether it was poor politics in Africa or Somalia, I'm glad you talked about what you did.
First question.
We learned a lot at a recent forum that the Kurds are, and this was Tom Ricks was here, are the largest people that don't have a nation. Please apply your thinking about nations and ethnicity to the example of Kurdistan. What should we do?
Okay, great question. Actually, they are the largest people in the world that don't have a state. They are a nation. They're probably two nations, because the Kurds in Turkey, they're about 20 million Kurds. About half of them live in Turkey. There's 6 million in Iraq and 2 or 3 in Syria and 2 or 3 in Iran. They all are from the same ethnic group, but they've been separated by a border now for a long time, so that they are not entirely a nation, but they certainly are the largest group of its kind. The Kurds in Iraq are demanding autonomy. They would prefer independence, but they've agreed, they're very friendly to the United States, and we want Iraq to stay one state, so they're going to stay in it as long as it's one state. But when it starts breaking up, they will be an independent state and look to us to help them. The Kurds in Turkey were brutally, and Kurds everywhere, were brutally treated by Kemal Ataturk when he overthrew the Sultanate. He called them Mountain Turks. He wouldn't let them speak Kurdish on the street or in their bedrooms or any place. The population grew, so I assume they said something in their bedrooms. But he denied them any rights whatsoever. That has been easing up somewhat. You can now speak Kurdish. There are Kurdish newspapers. There's a Kurdish radio. Nevertheless, the Kurds are still not happy in Turkey, and there's still occasional terrorist acts and so on. The Turks will never allow independence for Kurdistan. Because in eastern Turkey, where the Kurds are, all the water for the Middle East arises. The Tigris, the Euphrates, all the water that goes into Iraq and Syria and Israel and the whole place and Turkey comes out of Turkish Kurdistan. They built a huge dam system there called the Kemal Ataturk Dam, which provides power for Turkey. So they're not going to do it. One of the reasons that the Europeans, I think Europe is using it as an excuse, but they say, we will not take you in until you behave better to the Kurds, because you have human rights violations. I think that Europe really doesn't want an 80 million population of Muslims able to travel freely in Europe at this time, but they don't want to say so. So they're using Kurdistan. So Iraqi Kurdistan will probably do very well. Turkish Kurdistan could do well, but I think the Turks are going to have to ease up and find ways to reconcile the Kurdish people to staying in Turkey, and that may mean some autonomy without giving them full independence. Is that adequate as an answer to that question? It's a good question. It's important.
This was a different questioner, and the first question asked two questions. What future do you see for Kurdish nation? We've already discussed that. Second was, will Iraq ultimately be split up again as it was before the British Empire?
Well, that's the question of the day. We don't know. Joe Biden, who went out there with Les Gelb several times after 2003, suggested that somehow they come together with a loose federation of three different provinces, each with a lot of autonomy, with a central government that controlled foreign relations and had an army, with some very carefully written language about the distribution of petroleum. In the Constitution, it says that existing petroleum resources will belong to the federal government. And they will be used by the proceeds to be divided, because there's no petroleum so far discovered in the Sunni part of Western Iraq. They believe there's petroleum under the ground, but they haven't found it. New petroleum found will be used by the province in which it is found. If they find new resources, that province will profit from that petroleum. One of the things is that Kirkuk is on the border between Kurdistan and the Sunni part of Iraq. And Kirkuk is in the middle of an enormous petroleum well, great field. And the Kurds say it's ours, and the Sunnis say it's theirs. So there's renewed strife around Kurdistan. I think that's an attractive solution that Biden came up with. Whether it can be implemented, whether it can be accepted in this very volatile atmosphere, I don't know. I really don't. It may be that for the time being, they're going to have to settle for what we like to call Saddam Light. Get another dictator, but not as bad a one. And Mr. Alawi may be the choice for that, who is a Shia Arab, but a reasonably secular one, who seems to get along pretty well with Sunnis. So that if he can persuade the Kurds to stay in a mix like this, that may be a more stable solution than trying to implement this three-province thing. And coming apart into three entirely separate states, I don't think that's likely. I don't think the people want it, because it'd be an invitation to others to cross the borders. The Turks sometimes look over at the Kurds and say, hey, you know, why are those Kurds down there when they used to be part of our empire? The Iranians are looking at Kurdistan with some hungry eyes, and looking at the entire part of Iraq, southern Iraq as well. And other states have ambitions about Iraq, should it break up into three much weaker provinces. So I suspect it will stay together as one country in some form or other.
All right, we'll switch a little bit further east, and this relates to whether countries can stay together. We hear about only a few nations in China, for example, the Uyghurs, but there are several different languages, Mandarin, Cantonese, etc. And there must have been many different nations in China in earlier years. Is the Chinese nation-state vulnerable to the nations within it? And if not, what is now and will be in the future their secret to success?
The thing that held China together, the Han Chinese from the First Empire, which was in the first century B.C., was the imperial dream for China, which is prosperity, harmony, and longevity. In other words, continued government. The word for democracy in China translates to chaos. And so they're not wild about it. We think chaos would be good for you. So there's a feeling in Chinese, which the invaders, like the Mongols and others who invaded China, quickly adopted. Longevity, prosperity, and harmony. That's what we want. So that Chinese have a tradition of feeling that way. The Uyghurs have been badly treated. They're Turkish, they're Muslim, or Turkic, they speak a Turkish language. The Chinese may be able to incorporate them into the Han system or offer them some autonomy, but the Chinese are reluctant to offer autonomy because that's not harmony. I suspect they'll keep leaning on the Uyghurs, and nobody is going to intervene in China to save the Uyghurs.
But I tell you one thing, there's a question that's even better and says how appreciative we are that you came here. And this question was, ask him, when can you come back?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it was great. It was so good. Oh, that's good. Seriously.